Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is, where are we now in the pandemic? And what is the science really warning us about? To understand this, we've invited Dr. James Lyons Weiler, W-E-I-L-E-R. He's a PhD. He is the CEO and director of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, which performs research in the public interest aimed at finding ways to reduce human suffering. And his research program is currently focused on aluminum toxicity, autoimmunity, and the differences in health outcomes between highly vaccinated versus non-vaccinated children. He is a lifelong biomedical researcher. He is the best-known person for contributions to advanced medical bioinformation and for his three books, Ebola, An Evolving Story, Cures versus Profits, Successes in Translational Research, and The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. He is a true blue academic. He has directed the analysis of data from over 100 medical studies, served as founding editor-in-chief of the journal Cancer Informatics, is currently the editor-in-chief of the journal Science, Public Health and Policy, and Law, and has published more than 57 papers in highly respected journals. He has created an online university which is to prepare bring reason, logic, and scientific facts to the debates in the public square. His blog, let me spell it for you, jamesloinsweiler.com. It contains deep analysis of issues that confront us today on the mismatches that exist between biomedical science and public health policy. The IPAC, I-P-A-K, can be visited at ipaknowledge.org. Nice to have you back with us, James.
Oh, thank you so much, Gary. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Clearly, from the statistics and positive cases from asymptomatic individuals, far outnumber those who show signs of some kind of respiratory infection. Of course, this is all related to the reliance upon the PCR tests for diagnosing. The question of PCR accuracy has been something you have been carefully investigating in the scientific literature. There seems to be a wide discrepancy in the rates of false positive results. And Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in 1996 for discovering the PCR, told me, and it's an hour and 50-minute interview that's up on GaryNall.com, that you cannot use his test to make a proper diagnosis, nor can you distinguish in which coronavirus that you're actually seeing with a PCR test, nor can you say that the positive is meaning you're currently a case active, meaning you're infected. And yet that's exactly what we're doing. Also, there are different forms of the PCR. One in Europe, for example, which is used by most of the European countries and also Great Britain and Germany, for example, that one is considered extremely unreliable, yet it has not been withdrawn from the marketplace. Then you have the PCR test amplifying any kind of virus or material. And only recently did Anthony Fauci say, after over a year plus of, you know, telling people get your PCR test taken, that, oh, above 35 repetitions, it's not accurate. You don't know what you have and it's not important. But then we find a lot of labs are using 45 replications to magnify. And by the time they magnify enough of these magnifications to actually see something, there's no way that that's going to be pathogenic. And then we're told by the New York Times, in a shameless exploitation of public trust, that they chose to use the term case active case versus PCR positive, because you could be PCR positive and be completely asymptomatic. But the concept in people's mind is that, oh, a case is an active disease. So just on this topic, people are confused, and yet there are long lines all across America. And then just common sense and basic epidemiology. If you have no one being tested on the PCR at all, let's say there were no tests, then how many cases would you have reported? Clearly only those who are symptomatic. And then if you took all the cases that are reported, how many are older people with 2.6 comorbidities and who are in nursing homes, assisted living centers, hospice care, or are very sick and are near death in any case? Well, then would that justify, if those are the primary people and the largest percentage of people who are manifesting actual disease and dying, then how many of those people died because of COVID versus simply having COVID? Again, these are questions that have not seen the truth presented to the public because so many people involved have it in their interest, financial interest, career interest, to keep the official narrative going. So if you would please, James, go through this and show what should be legitimately challenged based upon independent, objective science. That's what you are involved with, to show us the truth and separate out that from the myth. The forum is yours.
Oh, thank you very much, Gary. So beginning with the correct assessment that the PCR test alone is insufficient for diagnosis, that's true for almost any individual diagnostic. Almost any individual diagnostic, it cannot be used as a screen. We don't use CT scans to screen for cancer, because if we did, the prevalence of cancer at any given time is so low that the number of false positives that we would get and the number of biopsies that would result from using a CT scan to check the tissue to see if it truly is cancerous would vastly outnumber the true positive cancers that were found. And we would be subjecting most people who tested positive to unnecessary biopsies, infections. So the details of PCR also make this complicated. You know, it's wrong to screen for COVID. It's wrong to do indiscriminate testing for COVID. The reality is that, as you expertly and correctly stated, we can't be sure what's in the sample, even if we have a positive test. A positive PCR result does not only does it not mean a confirmatory diagnosis of COVID-19, we're not even sure if you amplified COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The problem with PCR at high cycle numbers is that in the presence of any nucleic acid source, PCR reactions eventually take off. They eventually reach an exponential curve, and they will eventually reach the point where you have enough amplification where the machine will tell you you've reached the fluorescence level. And when you talked about cycle numbers, since we repeat the cycling of temperatures in PCR, in the lab we go through three different temperatures and we cycle those three different temperatures over and over again. The question is, how many cycles do you have for a person before they reach a certain amount of replicated DNA or RNA material? It's always DNA. The RNA is transcribed into DNA first. But if you set your cycle threshold too high, you'll get a problem called push-through, and you'll be able to detect or diagnose COVID-19 in pineapples, for instance, or in ducks, or in, you know, any source, carrot test positive. And so there's a very, very serious problem with not only do we know what's present in the sample, but if the virus is present, is a virus viable? A viral fragment will amplify. And a viral fragment being present also, as you correctly surmised, may not be related in any way to a person's current symptoms. They may have bacterial pneumonia. and that's a grave concern. Or they may have, you know, fallen out of a window and died, and they had COVID-19, and they're given a COVID-19 death determination because the result of a PCR test. And so looking at this logically, scientifically, mathematically, I have conducted a thorough analysis of the CDC's logic flow diagram, where if you are tested, well, first of all, if you present with potential symptoms, you may be tested or not tested. If you are tested, you may be positive, you may be test negative. If you're test negative, or if you're not tested at all, a clinician can still say that I think that this patient had COVID and report you as COVID. Your case is COVID-19. But if you test positive, then you still have to go through, well, is the virus truly present? And if the virus is truly present, is it there in sufficient quantity to have, you know, to be responsible for any sort of disease? Or is it, as Dr. Fauci called them, dead viral fragments or dead nucleotides? And if they test positive, each of these options has the negative outcome as well. So, you know, the positive outcome being that you have a virus, or the virus was sufficient to cause disease, or the virus was related to your death. Each one of those in the decision tree has the opposite answer: no, it wasn't. And there's a conundrum that's afoot that is really, really dangerous. We're playing with fire in terms of the safety of our civilization, Western civilization in particular. Because we're doing indiscriminate testing, we're at risk of actually shutting down people's lives for no reason. The majority of people testing positive, not having COVID-19, then have to quarantine for 10 or 14 days, depending on where you live. And if you're quarantining, then you also then are not being a productive member of society. You have problems taking care of your aging parents. You can't keep down the shop. It's very disruptive to your business, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a drain on, you know, well-being of individuals, communities, and the nation. And so without the ability to actually know I have the virus and the virus is causing a problem in me, we're all subjected to being locked down, our own personal lockdown in these quarantines. And if enough of us test positive, a sufficiently great percentage, we're all at risk of another lockdown, either at the city, county, you know, state level, whatever. And so this cost, these costs accrue. As you know, the teen suicide rate has skyrocketed following COVID. Deaths of despair and people that have lost their jobs and lost their businesses, lost their life savings, lost their relationships, you know, the added stress, the social distancing, the isolation, all add to the column of why we cannot tolerate false positives. But the official party line until even after Dr. Fauci came out and said that, yes, when the CT score is too high, public health officials were still denying that there were any false positives in this process whatsoever. As the editor-in-chief of Science, Public Health Policy, and the Law, I received a manuscript submitted by Dr. Ely and colleagues who, through their own analysis, they had determined that the CDC violated federal law by skipping through the process and not subjecting their change in diagnosis and death determination procedures to proper oversight. And they made it up as they went along. And I remember Dr. Birx back in April 2020 making the announcement that, unlike other countries, the CDC was going to determine that anyone who died with COVID-19 died from COVID-19. It doesn't take a medical degree to know that the virus could be present or even a test could be positive and not in any way associated with the person's death. So we correctly published that following rigorous peer review, and USA Today picked up on it and cited a biostatistician from Michigan who said that the most important variable is more testing. We have to have more testing. And this is why I undertook my logical mathematical analysis, and I found out and it's in peer review right now. We'll have to call it preliminary data for now, but the preliminary results. I've determined mathematically and logically that under the circumstances that CDC has set up, the more arbitrary testing you do, the more indiscriminate testing you allow, the higher the false positive rate of the overall diagnostic flowchart. Now, I'm not just talking about that this will result in a larger number of cases that are found. As you correctly said, a case is not a case in COVID-19. I'm talking about the fact that for every person that you add to the testing program, you're increasing the overall likelihood of finding false positives. The ratio of false positives to positives actually increases. It's not linear. It's nonlinear. It's actually curvilinear. And this matches the expectations of Basil et al. It's a team from Australia who correctly determined empirically by looking at the PCR tests and sequencing, determining the actual status of the samples, that 11% of the samples that they looked at were false positives. And they correctly reported that when the infectious agent like SARS-CoV-2 is at low prevalence in the population, and we've never been above 2% infection at any given time in the United States, probably never been above 1.5% in most places in the United States by far, then the problem is that at low prevalence, the false positives greatly outweigh and outnumber the true positives. So all of the attendant costs of having a false positive are visited upon society and individuals, and they're completely externalized to public health. They're completely externalized to medical, the medical practices that conduct this testing. So if you're going to be doing any PCR testing, it should only be done, in my view, and this is mathematically, as a logician, not as a clinician, this, you should only do it on people who are truly symptomatic with this collection, the constellation of symptoms that we know are associated with SARS-CoV-2 infection. They include dry hacking cough. They include pain while you're coughing, the pain like you've never felt before. They include, and this is a symptom of high viremia, which means that you're susceptible to transmission. They include the loss of the sense of taste or smell and a fever. And if those people are tested with PCR, then what you've done is you've enriched the population that you're actually testing to the point where the number of true positives greatly outnumber the number of false positives, and testing is worthwhile as a confirmatory or a step along the way for diagnosis. So using PCR for confirmatory, that you think that the person clearly has some type of virus, the PCR should test positive. The actual messiness with which the PCR testing has been rolled out across the world, in the Western world in particular, I should call it the vaccinating world, most of the vaccinating populations, the countries, if you will, nations, has been so messy. In the UK, throughout Europe, in fact, the test that was used originally required that 2 out of 3 of the primer pairs, right? When you do a PCR, you're trying to amplify a segment of a nucleotide sequence. And so you have to have the beginning of the sequence and the end of the sequence. And so you have primer 1 and primer 2. They come in pairs. Well, they had 3 different primer pairs. And the decision rule that was adopted, and it was reasonable at the onset, was that we're going to give a person a test positive result if they had 2 out of 3 primer pairs that, you know, lit up as positive on nucleotide amplification during the PCR reaction. And slowly but surely, they got around to sequencing the whole genomes of viruses that were, you know, taken from people. And they found that there was a strain, it was the UK strain or the South African strain, that actually seemed to be flourishing and spreading independent of all the other strains. And thorough analysis led to the conclusion that one of the primers that was found on the spike protein of all places, which is a ridiculously bad place to choose a primer. You're supposed to choose conserve sites, and the spike protein is, you know, the most targeted part of the virus proteome. Our immune system targets it, the vaccine targets it, and now we have a test that's targeting it. So if you're going to see any changeover, the mutations are going to come to increase in frequency and go to fixation in the population of viruses. It'll be something that allows it to escape the immune system or escape the vaccine-induced reactions, immune reactions, or escape the test. And it turns out that 8.5% of all the mutations that are found in the new variants, the emerging variants that are coming out, actually map to PCR primer locations. Now, these PCR primers, these sites, these regions are only 21 nucleotide bases, 21 letters in a row, A, T, Cs, and Gs. The genome is 29,000 base pairs long. So the selection coefficient or the strength of selection to escape the test must be huge. And this is why we see variation that is causing the virus to escape the test, and that's why it's flourishing. It's not flourishing because it's more transmissible. It's flourishing because we didn't really think ahead that perhaps evolution is creative, perhaps evolution is powerful, natural selection. And so with 8.5% of the variants found in these causing test escape, I think it's a matter of time. And I think this is why the United States is dragging their feet on whole genome sequencing of SARS-CoV-2 in spite of the promise of billions of dollars. Because they know what they'll find. They'll find that the virus is, you know, transmitting freely across the population, irrespective of testing and lockdowns. That's how complicated this is. It's utterly futile. From a population perspective, from an individual's perspective, if you're high risk and you want to increase the chances that you're going to avoid being exposed, you might want to use testing in your life. But it should never be used as a whole population screen. And that's why at IPAC, the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, we have joined and are leading the NATTEC Consortium. It's NAATEC. It stands for Nucleic Acid Assay Technology Evaluation Consortium. The members of the consortium include Professor Dolores Cahill, Dr. Singheng Li, Dr. Henry Ely, Kevin Jenkins, Tara Thornton, and Susan Sweeten, among others. Our goal is to provide clinical samples to Dr. Li's lab so that when a person is a candidate for the CDC's testing procedures, we actually have a sample that we can put through more sophisticated, more accurate nucleic acid technologies like DNA sequencing. We can take the RNA from the virus, transform it to DNA, just as it would be done for the PCR test. And we can conduct Sanger sequencing, which the FDA has published is the gold standard validation for PCR. And Dr. Li and I are working on the primer selection, the strategies of how to make sure that if our test shows that it's positive, our research, this is all research, this is not for clinical use, that the virus is present, that the virus is truly present, and that we're not going to be fooled by variants that cause our assay to miss a virus if it's truly there. We also want to outfit Dr. Li with the next generation sequencer so that he can do the whole genome sequencing that's necessary, because we're not just going to be testing for coronavirus. We would like to determine what percentage of alleged coronavirus cases actually are influenza A or influenza B or bacterial pneumonia or respiratory syncytial virus or perhaps our bacterial pneumonia. And they're being misdiagnosed by the testing facility who tell elderly people in America, if you have a respiratory illness, you're not feeling well, and you came to get tested, go home for 10 to 14 days to see if you need emergency care. If you end up going to the emergency room, you probably have COVID. That's a crime. That's medical malfeasance. That's neglect. It's across the board. You know, I just learned that NASA put a plaque to healthcare workers as heroes for making sure that we're all safe against COVID-19. And it's a bit of a, it puts a sour taste in my mouth, because in reality, what the healthcare community did, the medical community, is they turned their back on the public and said, we can't be overwhelmed. We can't be bothered by all of these coronavirus cases. So we need 2 weeks. We need 2 weeks to get our stuff together, and then you guys can start showing up. Well, 2 weeks, it's been over a year now, well over a year. We're into April now. It's the end of April. So when we take a look at, you know, who the heroes are in this, to me, I think the heroes are the people that are standing up for bringing forward objective science and truth about, you know, what the causes of death are, what the rates are, what the actual data say. The flim-flam that we're being sold in terms of diagnostic testing, Gary, you may have also seen that CDC uses one CT score for diagnosis of COVID-19, but now they've lowered the CT threshold for the diagnosis of breakthrough infections in people who are vaccinated. So they have a double standard. It's one CT score if you're not vaccinated, and it's another CT score if you are vaccinated. This is completely unacceptable, and I consider it to be complete fraud. So,
James, it's corrupt. It's the weaponization of science, in my opinion. I want to go a little further on this, but I want to have an overarching analysis first. So we keep this in lay language so the audience who are not in the sciences can appreciate it. Historically, we never quarantined the entire population, not even during the 1918 flu that was devastating. Instead, we quarantined those most at risk and those who are ill. That's reasonable and responsible science. We've quarantined everybody. We also are now looking at over, at least that I'm aware of, probably more, 87 separate companies bringing out their own variant COVID vaccines. As a result of that, to support that, the mainstream media, which has been extremely lax in its objective science reporting, or simply out-and-out biased, they have said that these variants are deadly and it's a whole new strain and, you know, once again, pushing the panic button. And I went to the science and I was looking at all these different, what we knew about the variants, and I was not saying this. Because normally, many variants are actually weaker than the original one, and they contain about 97% of the original genome. And so things can be rather predictable. So I'm saying, why are they pushing the panic button? Now they're priming people to have their third booster shot. That's what's being advocated by the CEO of Pfizer and Moderna. They're advocating for regular Bill Gates. Now you're going to have a coronavirus vaccine at least once a year, if not multiple times. Now the variant ideas, we could be asking people or demanding it that they have a variant vaccine every single month of the year indefinitely. Also, this is a part of this that I have no understanding of. I'm simply clueless. All of the scientific literature, epidemiological literature and other literature from other specialties shows that children, infants, teenagers, young people, are not going to be dying in any statistically significant numbers from COVID. There's no representation of that. There's almost a 99.99% survival rate with this. But the annual influenza does kill people of all ages, including young people. So why would you mandate a vaccine for them? And that's what's happening. In Israel, it's already occurring. But in the United States, now there are two separate studies going on, one by Moderna, at least that I'm aware of, probably more, and one by Pfizer that, oh, we're testing children, but already a child has died in this. Isn't one child who didn't need to die, isn't one death enough when you're doing something completely theoretical, a pure hypothesis, with no ability to determine is it really safe or effective or even do they need it? But no one in the media thus far, I've been checking the BBC, I've been checking all the different national publications, no one's suggesting that children should not have it because they have a more natural immunity in their body. That no, they got to have it. They got to have it. They got to have it. And I'm seeing an agenda that is frightening. And that's why I say I don't know what their ultimate motives are, but it sure is the dickens not saving young people's lives or giving them quality of life. Then there's another tentacle into this multi-tentacled morass, and that is that when you look at who's dying and has died, and then you look at the people who are not being tested for COVID, and because they're asymptomatic and say, well, I'm okay, but I was a little sick for one day, I believe, and again, this is pure hypothesis, James, I'm not suggesting anything else than it's my best guess, that a large percentage of the American population, how large I do not know, have already confronted the virus and their body's immune system was able to kill the virus and create antibodies. So it would make sense not to vaccinate someone who already has met the virus and now they have natural immunity. How long that natural immunity lasts, we don't know. But historically, if you have the measles, you have chickenpox, you're immune for life. I'm not suggesting this will make you immune for life, but I am suggesting you're going to have a substantial benefit because you have natural immunity. And we're not even discussing natural immunity. So why would you vaccinate, let's just say for purely argument's sake, 40% of the American population, in fact, probably in other countries as well, have already met the virus and the body has won because you cannot quarantine from any virus. This is in the air. It's in people. We're spreading it. But that's also creating, for a lot of people, their natural defense mechanism. Now, older people with comorbidities, yes, they meet the virus. They may or may not survive. We found out that if you're an older person over the age of 70 and you're healthy, as many are, and you have no comorbidities and you're taking your vitamin D3 at 10,000 units a day and zinc at 50 milligrams and vitamin C at 5,000 milligrams a day and selenium at 200 micrograms a day and you're on a healthy diet, you're exercising, your immune system makes you substantially protected. And they're not even emphasizing that. Hence, they're not emphasizing prevention. I haven't heard Fauci, I haven't heard the presidents, either one, Trump or Biden, I haven't heard the Surgeon General, I haven't heard U.S. Public Health Service, the World Health Organization. So you know something? We know that people who have vulnerable immune systems are most likely with comorbidities to succumb or be infected. So why don't we have a Marshall Plan, a medical Marshall Plan, to get people to lose weight in a healthy way, get their immune systems built up, and oh, by the way, there's over 45,000 articles on PubMed, the Library of Medicine, in the peer-reviewed literature supporting that these will work. And by the way, I know that because Richard Gale and I did an article on that over a year and 1 month ago. Not a word. So they're not intellectually incapable. They're very bright people, highly, highly respected because of their knowledge and expertise, yet they haven't even mentioned once. If you require hospitalization, then we'll work on you. Are you using hyperbaric oxygen? No, they're using intubation. Well, that's not working. We had massive amounts of iatrogenic episodes because of that. And pulmonologists were the first to ring the bell. This is not working the way with these ventilators. We're on the wrong track. He was dismissed and he was deplatformed. Now we know that if you're using and I'm not even talking about alternative therapies. I have not even had an alternative physician on my show in almost a year talking about this. I wanted the orthodox pro-vaccine scientists and physicians to show why they have concern and have alternative approaches. And it was those scientists who gave us ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And they took a beating for that. Now, science should never be certain of anything because then it becomes orthodox and it ceases to be real science. Everything changes sooner or later, and only later do we understand what mistakes we made earlier. So when you're destroying a person's career, example, the professor who's an oncologist at Yale University who's published over 300 papers in the peer-reviewed literature, he's a world-leading epidemiologist. In fact, he sits on the boards, or did, of six of the major medical scientific magazines in the world. He never had a controversy his entire career, not one controversy. And yet now all the faculty in his own department are demanding his ouster. Why? What did he do wrong? And it turns out he was not wrong. What was wrong was the political campaign, not scientific, to destroy any need to show that hydroxychloroquine actually worked. It was attacked in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet. Both of those had to be retracted. And now, the same with ivermectin. The man who brought us the attention of how important hydroxychloroquine was, ivermectin, at 3 milligrams prophylactically for people who are susceptible, that man has lost his job. Now, mind you, these are orthodox board-certified people, responsible people. They all sat at the same table at one time in their careers. They're all fired. The media doesn't look at this. They don't look at what happens when you weaponize the response to a pandemic, where you control the narrative. That's what's happened. So I'm seeing virtually everything that they have done up to this moment and are going forward doing is not based upon anything I would call credible gold standard science. Because if we really cared about science, we'd be measuring antibodies to this in people and then saying, okay, you had the virus, you got the antibodies, you have some measure of protection, so you don't have to have the vaccine. Because now we're seeing the adverse effects of the vaccine. And mind you, when I spoke and interviewed the former head of the FDA, an MD, PhD, he said that upwards a maximum of 10% of adverse reactions, because it's voluntary, are ever recorded. But they could be as low as 1%. So let's give him the advantage. Let's say it's 10%. That means that we've had about 30,000 deaths in the United States. In Europe, over 70,000 deaths. That means we've had almost 2 million adverse effects in Europe, and in the United States, probably in the neighborhood of 500,000 adverse effects. So why is it that we are not looking at the actual science and seeing that everything we're doing is misguided? And I don't understand what the motive could possibly be. That's a lot of additional points to take on. I'll stay quiet now and give you the rest of the show to unravel that.
Well, thank you, Gary. Everything you said resonates with my understanding of reality. So the children enjoy innate immunity to viruses. It's much stronger, as you well know. The oxides, the nitric oxide, nitrous oxides, all of the, you know, reactive oxygen systems. And these are very, very important in fighting viruses, and that's how the human body prefers to fight viruses. In fact, we don't want people who have COVID-19 or who have the SARS-CoV-2 to mount a strong antibody response, because the people that have the strongest antibody response are the ones that get into trouble. Children, if you think about this from an epidemiologic standpoint, it's unfathomable that they've decided to experiment on children when there's zero benefit to the child who's enrolled in the trial. They should calculate the number needed to vaccinate to prevent one case of COVID in children. And then there's probably have to vaccinate more children than there are on the planet to prevent one death in children, because they simply don't get this disease. They don't transmit the disease. They don't get sick from this, you know, infection. So, and that nitric oxide strategy in the body is mimicked by a nasal spray. There's a trial out of the UK and in Canada by Sanitize. There's a nitric oxide spray that stops this virus dead in its tracks within 24 hours in 95% of the recipients. And it's sailed through phase 2 clinical trials. It's moving on to phase 3. So the science is on our side. In terms of the screening to see if people are immune, yes, antibodies, but better yet, right, the T cells, and there was a study in October 2020 out of Sweden that showed that people who were household members of people that had COVID-19 have T cell robust immunity, memory immunity, without symptoms or with mild symptoms. So yeah, we can count on it. I would expect from a biological standpoint, an immunological standpoint, that natural immunity against SARS-CoV-2 would be much greater than any of the spike only vaccines, simply because there's a greater repertoire of B cell and T cells, a greater diversity of B cells and T cells that can dominate when through the intracellular, the cell-based, cell-mediated immunity. And so I recently did some math on it. In fact, I just published a new article on my blog. It says, the title is, "So You're Not Vaccinated, Are You Really Preventing Herd Immunity? The Devil's in the Detail." And if you take out the 13% of Americans that a journal in The Atlantic claims will never get the shot, and you calculate the number of people who have had COVID-19, according to CDC, and the 200 million doses that have been given out, we're already above 85% immunity. And Dr. Fauci's range was between 75 and 85%, based on a gut feeling. Well, that was also based on a false representation of the efficacy of the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. The original claim of 95.4%, I showed mathematically, was actually 75%, because unbelievably, they were allowed in their study, somehow it passed scrutiny other than my own. The 95% efficacy of Moderna's trial was achieved by removing people from the study who had developed a COVID-19 diagnosis after the first shot, and they were not given the second shot. And that would be like studying chemotherapy agents that takes three courses and excluding the people who died after the first course of the chemo and amplifying your survival rate. There's proper ways to do this, and they didn't do it the proper way. They simply dropped them from the study. They didn't perform something called censoring, if those are people who are interested in understanding how this should be done. But when I recalculated, it was 75%. At 75% efficacy, right, in the ideal population, remember these were super healthy people too. In the ideal population, 95% efficacy becomes 75% efficacy when you include all the patients that were actually in the study. And then on top of that, it was an ideal population, no comorbidities, no autoimmunity, et cetera. That vaccine efficacy of 75% means that the vaccine coverage for a virus like SARS-CoV-2 has to be a 100%. We have to have 100% coverage. And so we were misled by the false hope of a vaccine that would lead to herd immunity. We could go back to normal, we were told. We could unmask, we were told. We would go back and hug grandma, we were told, over a vaccine that right from the get-go never had a chance of giving us herd immunity. It was never going to happen. I'm very sorry to hear, you know, again about that Yale University professor who lost his job. That person should get a hold of me. I can certainly use a smart person like that at IPAC. Maybe we can get you doing some interesting and important things. But something I wanted to share with you, Gary, in your audience, that 80% of people who have developed serious COVID-19 or died from COVID-19, they had pre-existing conditions, yes. But 80% of people actually had pre-existing autoimmune antibodies, if they had serious COVID-19 or died, compared to 7 or 8% of people with mild COVID-19 who had pre-existing autoimmunity. They have a Th2 skewed immune system. The body's reacting to the virus as if it's a bacterium, right? It's not using the more subtle and elegant innate immunity. And so, we as adults in the United States being unhealthy, yes, we should exercise, we should get more sunshine, vitamin D, and hug each other much more frequently, and be friendly to your neighbor. We should do all the good things we know are good for us. But we should also recognize that the probability of serious COVID-19, the probability of dying from COVID-19 is extremely small, extraordinarily small, once you account for the screening. We should screen people for prior autoimmunity and say, okay, you're at high risk of serious COVID-19. What can we do to get your Th1 balance back? This to me is the number one health problem in the United States. It should be the number one health priority. Now that we're no longer killing people by the hundreds of thousands with false COVID-19 diagnosis by throwing them on ventilators hopefully we're going to improve in denying people care for their pneumonia as well. So understanding this as well as we do, yes, they're smart people, they're intelligent people. You don't want to speculate on their motivation. But the most important thing that we can do is promote treatment. There's going to be massive societal upheaval over that last 13%, or I guess 17-18% that may or may not vaccinate. And to be sure, there are people who we have to expand our vocabulary now. There's a collection of half vaxxers. There's millions of people who only would take one vaccine. They wouldn't take both doses because the first vaccine was so horrible. So what do we do? Do we just allow this to inexorably roll down the road and like a train wreck, watch the anti-vaxxers, vaccine risk aware community become a second class citizen group, have their social rights abused or civil rights abused, be treated as if they're pariahs because they're causing the problem? Or do we put the responsibility for this debacle back on the public health people who told us that we had a vaccine that was 95% effective? That's why we signed on to get vaccinated. That's why the majority, I've not been vaccinated, but the people who have been vaccinated, they thought that they were doing a good thing because they could march towards herd immunity and that they would be contributing to herd immunity. Actually, it turns out that most people, the number one reason why they took the vaccine was to protect themselves in the United States. But for those people who thought that it would be a good thing to do for society and enjoy the idea that perhaps we were all in this together and we can reach herd immunity. The Atlantic article that I cited and wrote an article about actually has a byline, and the byline reads, "We may never reach the point where viral spread stops, but a strategy of minimizing risk, not eliminate it, can help Americans reclaim normalcy." That's very carefully worded. It can help us reclaim normalcy. That's like saying that, you know, this product may help you grow hair. That's marketing, right? There's a marketing strategy. It can help you grow hair. It won't cause you to grow hair, but it'll help you. And so the number one thing that we need to do, and everybody that's concerned about this debacle of a train wreck that is going to happen in our society, and it has been happening in our society, is to promote the treatments. We should make this a trivial disease to treat. And that's what's happening in the UK. In the UK, they realize, hey, wait a minute, there's way, way too much adverse events from their vaccine that they thought was going to come to market. In the UK, they're now turning with great interest to ivermectin. Dr. John Campbell, who has millions of followers over the past year on YouTube, just interviewed Pierre Corey over ivermectin. The UK is opening its arms to treatments. Now, it's just a matter of time because we speak the same language before that information is going to flow into our society and people are going to start demanding treatments. So you really have to look at the nitrous oxide, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. Go to CE19study.com and share this information. We have to say that part of the solution, that's a peaceful solution, it's a path towards wellness, it's a path to reduce human pain and suffering, both from COVID-19 infection, but also the pain and suffering we may inflict on each other, the social strife and the battles that might occur between family members, neighbors, coworkers. Just respect each other and look out for each other's wellness by saying all the options should be on the table. Imagine if you took your car to the mechanic and you said to the mechanic, and the mechanic said to you, "I'd like to fix your car, but due to regulatory reasons, I'm not allowed to use anything but screwdrivers. I can't use wrenches. I can't use anything but screwdrivers on your car." How well do you think that mechanic is going to do at fixing everyone's car? We need to use all the tools in the toolbox.
James, I have what I hope will be an important answer for the audience. Right now, there is no hard evidence that I'm aware of, but you may know better. Yesterday, we distributed the announcement of a study conducted by the Institut Pasteur in France. It raised a question for us that I hope you can respond to. The study found that whether a person has asymptomatic or symptomatic infection, polyfunctional antibodies, which include natural killer cells, are generated. And these antibodies are capable of killing any cells that are infected, regardless of whether a person has symptoms or not. So the question is, if our body cells are expressing the COVID spike protein after receipt of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, then would the body's immune response of these natural killer cells end up attacking these otherwise healthy cells? In other words, a person who has no infection but receives the vaccines would be generating killer cells. This is a correct reading of the study, I believe. And if so, what would be the long-term risks this finding would present to those vaccinated with the RNA vaccines?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the study that was published that showed that human cell lines that are infected with other viruses that have reverse transcriptase or lines, these long inserted nucleotide that are thought to be silent, they may be dead silent viruses. We may have our own reverse transcriptase to allow this RNA to be become embedded in the human genome. And I'm also familiar with a study that shows that this particular RNA travels throughout the body. By far, most of it stays locally, but a significant non-zero percent of it makes it as far as into the brain. So the concern is a valid one, that perhaps different parts of a person's body will start expressing a foreign protein, and what is the immune system going to do with that? That is heaped upon the reality that people that have had recent COVID-19 may have residual viral particles in the antigen-presenting cells. This is Dr. Houman Nourkasim's concern. And so the people should be screened. He has the hashtag screen before vaccine, so that if you already have active immunity, current active IgM immunity, that the vaccine may pose a very serious risk. Well, those people that have those inserts into their genome, if they exist, to give that caveat, they will also have current IgM antibodies and appear to have an active infection, even if the virus is not replicating. So the screen before a vaccine would be a brilliant way to avoid further perturbing the immune system. And I suppose over time, without really getting an exaggerated immune response from the vaccine, perhaps the immune system would remove those cells slowly over time without necessarily causing great concern. My science in COVID-19, I'm best well known internationally as the guy who coined the phrase pathogenic priming. I have, my first study was published in April over concern of the matches between the unsafe epitopes that are in the virus and their matches through molecular mimicry and other causes of autoimmunity can cause autoimmunity from whether the virus is injected or the virus is acquired through infection. It's the repeated exposure that causes pathogenic priming to be a problem. So this prolonged exposure, I would imagine most people, if they have healthy immune systems, would diminish over time. The same way, Gary, I'm speculating now, but the same way that our body kills cancer all the time. Our body is very used to dispensing with cells that produce oddly shaped proteins that it shouldn't be producing.
Okay. James, let me finish this. We only have 2 minutes left. That would, I believe you're right on, but here's the caveat. This is the Pandora's box we have opened. We know that people who have failed immune systems, completely compromised immune systems, we do not know what is going to happen if they start getting the vaccines, but we have seen in some nursing homes a high percentage of the people who are COVID negative get the vaccine, become COVID positive, and they die. And this is not being properly reported. Richard Gill and I have been monitoring these deaths all across the world, and the media is not touching it. No one is bringing it up to Fauci. So everyone's supposed to get vaccinated. Every person on the planet, no matter what their physical condition, no matter if they've been met the virus in one or not, by Bill Gates. And they're the ones who are holding forth on the form. So is it not possible? I'm merely talking about the possibility, a hypothesis, that since we're giving people who are already nearing death, severely ill, you give those people the vaccine, couldn't that be changing in their body to where their actual cells? Okay? In any case, I'm sorry, we're out of time. That will be for our next interview, all right? So I thank you very much, James. You've been excellent. Thank you. For everyone listening, I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day. My mother, there's
watch too many of you cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you.